Welcome back to the Hunt Gather Talk podcast. I am your host, Hank Shaw. We are sponsored by eFish and Filson. Thank you for spending a part of your day with us. I'm very happy to say that today's episode is with a really good friend. It is my captain, Tyson Fick, of the fishing vessel Heather Ann. And we are going to talk about the romance and the reality of commercial fishing. Both of us have fished commercially for off and on for much of our lives. And I wanted to kind of relate with you just kind of what it's really like. And it is a profession that has an awful lot of myths that surround it that we're going to bust some and we're going to reinforce others, because commercial fishing is a very, very special industry, career, calling, really, if you will. And we're going to talk all about it. And I hope you enjoy the show. So without further ado, let's take it away. Tyson Fick, welcome to the Hunt Gather Talk podcast. You are no stranger to me, nor I to you, because you and I were shipmates aboard the fishing vessel Heather Ann for a fair bit of time a couple of years ago. And you are, I think, one of the only people I know who has come into commercial fishing after the age of 30. And I can't wait to talk about the realities and the romance that are commercial fishing, because we both experienced together. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we know each other from, I don't know, it's got to be a decade now, right?
Oh, at least.
So your first incarnation was, at least that I met you at, was you working for ASME, which is the Alaskan Seafood Marketing Institute.
Right. I was the communications director there for 7 years. And my job was to share the commercial fisheries, both the product and the experience of it in Alaska, kind of all over the world. And you came up on one of my all-time favorite little familiarization trips. And we motored around and checked fisheries out and whaled on fish and had a great time.
I think that was the one where Anita Lowe showed up as well.
One of my favorite chefs.
I know, mine too. So it's a media tour, right? So chefs and writers and such get to go on this really cool fishing trip. And, you know, not everybody's as hardcore as other people. So we're starting that first day of fishing. And Tyson provides everybody involved with some foul weather gear. And he like looks over and it's me and Anita putting on our own Grundins. And like, you could just see this like, ah, yes, actual hardcore fish killers. Mm-hmm. And I think Anita and I were the only two who fished every single moment of every single day.
Yeah, we even had to park the big boat in spots so we could fish at night. Crazy.
Yeah, we did. I caught that Irish Lord and ended up eating it, worms and all. So you're a commercial gill netter now, but you fished for a living before. You have experience before as a guide, don't you?
Yeah, so, you know, I kind of came full circle. When I was just out of high school, I did some work for my uncle in Kenai on the processing side. So we bought fish from gill netters, both set net and drift gill net, processed fish and shipped it off. And that was kind of one of my summer jobs all through college, was to go and work for him during the peak of the salmon season. Then when I got through school, my parents were super proud of me when I decided my chosen path was to be a snowboard bum in the winter and guide fishing in the summer. So for a lot of years, you know, again, more than a decade, I guided mostly salmon and trout northwest of Anchorage, where folks would fly out and then we'd drive around on jet boats, and developed into mostly fly fishing by the end. But, you know, we'd catch them any which way, including by hand if we had to.
That's got to be an interesting forward facing. We just did an episode called Deckhand Stories, which is a little bit different from like one-on-one guiding. And I imagine it's a bit more, your job there has to be a bit more like a personal psychologist as well as an angling guide.
Oh my God. It's a little bit of everything. I mean, it's not so simple as putting a hunk of meat on the bottom. People come at it with, they have a certain way they like to fish. So however they want to cast or drift or do whatever, you kind of got to try to figure out a way to help them be successful or just get out of their way. It was also like a wilderness guide. You know, I found it was pretty cool to know all the plants and the the flowers and the animals and be able to show people a real experience. And it was more than just about catching the fish. And if we weren't going to be out there for 4 or 5 days, you know, by the time I was done doing, I wasn't really that interested in taking somebody fishing just for the day, you know.
Gotcha.
So much pressure to have just the epic day. I'm in Alaska. It's going to be the best fishing in the world. And then, you know, not always that way every single day.
Even in Alaska.
even in some of the best fishing spots in the entire world. But I enjoyed it. That fit really well into the, you know, time working at ASME was having that experience of being able to show people parts of Alaska, wilderness, the fisheries, honor the fish themselves, and the hospitality side of it, having been around kitchens. Yeah, it was really great. And then, you know, a few years on, my kids are getting a little older, and I really wanted to introduce them to what it was about to be on the water more, and taking off and going to work at a lodge for 100 days and disappearing wasn't really in the cards. I became excited about the local salmon fishery. And for me, it wouldn't be that interesting to just go gillnet and then not have a connection to the whole process, you know, between, you know, everything from getting them off the boat to the final consumer. And I feel really lucky about that. And, you know, thank you for all your help there and your fans to help just connect that, make that connection from all the way from the ocean to the to folks. And now I've got lots of good friends all over the country that can send them fish. Great.
So one piece to that, you touched on it just briefly, is you have professional kitchen experience too. So you've been anything from like a shorter cook to, like me, a kind of a low-level line cook as well, right?
Correct. Right. So, you know, right out of high school, I worked on the railroad. I cooked going back and forth between Anchorage and Fairbanks. And we'd work 4 days on, and then I'd go to Kenai, and I'd work the salmon opener, and then I'd come railing back to make it to work on the train by 6 a.m., and we'd do it again. And that was kind of my Julys from, you know, all through growing up. And then out of college, you know, it worked out really well. My first job out of school was cooking at the hotel in Kotzebue, Alaska, north of the Arctic Circle. And did a number of different things from there, the oil field, restaurants, catering, and then moved on to the dining side of it.
Well, I bring that up really because, side note, so Tyson and I have spent long, long days and weeks offshore catching salmon, and you know, you get a chance to talk quite a bit. But even before that, the culinary experience, it's not just a fish to us, to you or to me. Because we both worked in kitchens, we have the ability to look at a fish that's just in a net or on an end of a hook and line and like, oh man, this is going to be a really good one. And I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that kind of changes the way you look at the whole process.
Absolutely. Just looking at it and seeing each fish and thinking about where it's going, not just a product, not just a $5 bill sitting there in the net, but it's actually somebody's special dinner. Somebody, it's a big deal for folks. It's not cheap and they're not easy to get. I feel like I owe it to the fish to take the best care of them and try to follow through on that promise.
So, okay. A guy is, oh man, you know, I'd love to be, I want to do this. I want to fish commercially. And you hear about it. In fact, the only thing you ever hear about when you hear about commercial fishing is that it's dying. And so, A, it seems to be wrong. And then B, how does somebody even get into it?
Well, it's, you know, yeah, it's relatively stable, I guess. Aging, like all of us. We talk about the graying of the fleet, and, you know, and I'm a young fisherman. It's pretty scary. But to get into it, I mean, the first thing, most people come at it from either first seeing the processing side or working on a tender, which is a larger boat that receives fish from the fishing boats and goes back and forth from the processing plant or cannery, or just walking the dock and being available. Word of mouth goes a long way. Because as you pointed out, you're going to spend a lot of time together. You're going to need to be meshing in the mind meld to happen, or it becomes pretty unpleasant for all parties involved, given the long hours and, you know, generally often unpleasant working environment. You better get along with folks.
But it's also got to be tremendously capitally intensive. I mean, you got to buy a boat, right?
Well, yeah, with limited entry fisheries, it's not as simple as just you got to buy a boat. You also have to buy a permit, and you have to buy nets, and you have to maintain your boat. You can get into it, you know, you can have a real inexpensive boat, but then you're left fixing it all the time, or maybe missing that big week because the fisheries, salmon especially, are so condensed at times. I mean, I could make half of my whole summer money in 2 weeks. And if I happen to be broken down those 2 weeks, that would be pretty crushing. So it's not cheap to get in it and stay in it. And neither should it be.
Quick shout out to one of our sponsors, eFish. They deliver fresh, never frozen, wild, American-caught, dayboat seafood right to your doorstep. What's unique about eFish is that they don't have a warehouse full of fish. They simply connect you straight to the source. This means that in most cases, your product is still swimming when you place an order. Their business operates in the same way. I order fish from my fishermen friends across the country. The fish goes straight from the dock to you overnight. It doesn't get much fresher than that unless you catch it yourself. With eFish, you can always be sure that your fish is ethically sourced, never treated with chemicals, and is handled with care from the minute it is hooked until it arrives in your doorstep. The holiday season is upon us, and now is the perfect time to try eFish. Whether you're cooking for your friends and family, or you want to send a unique and memorable gift to a distant loved one, eFish has you covered. From stone crab claws to lobster to halibut, eFish will elevate any holiday feast. They have even curated special holiday bundles that will ensure that no one at your dinner table was left hungry. So if you want to try fresh seafood for the holidays, check out eFish.com. That is e-fish.com. Get $15 off your first order with the code HUNTGATHERTALK. That is HUNTGATHERTALK, all one word. And again, check out e-fish.com. Let's just stop for a second. Explain to people listening out there exactly what gill netting is in terms of what we did in Alaska.
Gill netting is a method of catching fish, mostly, you know, in my work, it's all salmon, but any pelagic fish that moves through the water is a net that hangs like a giant curtain. So you've got floats on the top and then a mesh, monofilament mesh, and then you've got lead line on the bottom that holds it vertical in the water column, and the fish come swimming by. My partner Seth likes to remind me all the time how easy it is, and there's really nothing to it. All you have to do is drive in front of the fish and put your net down, and you'll just catch them all. They can't go backwards. Obviously, it's a little more to it than that, but
as we knew.
I've found every single mistake you can possibly make. I hope. But it's always something new, some new method of screwing up. So yeah, then it's mounted on the boat. In my instance, it's drift gill netting. So I'm boat-based. There's a big drum, or it looks like a giant fishing reel, that we let the net out. And by regulation, it's 1,200 feet long and no more than 60 meshes deep. We put the net out, let it drift for a while, bring the net in, detach from it, tow on the sides, depending on what the current's doing, or if there's some big log coming down the river, we'll hook onto it and drag it away.
Or hateful fur bags.
Oh my God, the seals and sea lions can do a pretty major bit of damage real fast. And when there's scratch fishing, so you're only getting a few, giving half of them to the seals can be a little frustrating. But I've gotten better about that, Hank. I don't take it so personally anymore.
I still have a deep animus to sea lions. Like seals are, they're kind of okay, whatever. But sea lions will ruin your net.
Well, that, and they're such show-offs. They're such dicks about it. They like grab the fish, they throw it around in the air, they splash around, the big bunch of seagulls show up. I don't know. They just have such an attitude. I don't mind feeding the seals. They're kind of halfway cute, but boy, those the sea lions are maybe just okay. Maybe I overstated it. I'm getting a little better about it.
So why do it? So like it's expensive. It's long hours. I mean, we would work. I mean, on certain days we'd work 20 hours and sleep four, and then you'd hear that miserable sound of the anchor chain going up 2 seconds after you put your head down on the V berth, and that means it's time to set a net again. And it's physically difficult. You're standing, you're dealing with knives, you're dealing with slimy fish, you're dealing with cold, you're dealing with black flies, you're dealing with the ever-present possibility of being swept away in the net, you know, sometimes bad weather. I mean, there's any number of things that can make this definitely ranging from unpleasant to downright dangerous. And yet you and I and pretty much everybody who does this job, I miss it. I miss it to this day. And that's why I came back, you know, because I fished commercially here and there as a kid. And then, you know, you gave me the opportunity to come back a few years ago and I jumped at it. And it's just, why do we do this crazy thing?
You know, for me, I wanted to be doing something that I was tangible, that was hard work. Like, I wanted to get back to that physical, bone tired, and knowing that you're doing something good for people by getting some fish out of the ocean, getting a small little piece of the harvest, taking the best care of it and sharing it with folks. Added to, I'm used to the seasonal work and the intensity of it, you know, make hay when the sun shines, and kind of loading that experience and, you know, trying to buy myself some free time in the rest of the year to, you know, be able to go and do things and be with my son.
It's also the greatest office in the world.
The view can be incredible. You see a lot of sunrises and sunsets.
I mean, even when it's crappy weather, it's still the best office in the world.
Oh, it's fun. And there's like an excitement to it. Gill netting in particular has that element almost of sport fishing that some other fisheries don't, that it's almost like bobber fishing, because when you're into the fish, you're seeing those corks bob around and fish splashing around. Like, you know, you're on a good drift.
Oh, yeah.
You know when you're in them or wanting to hang on one. Really, I know there's a little bit of competition to it, because even though we're all, you know, at the end of the day, we're all in this together. It's each boat for himself. It's not a quota. It's just we get time and area. And then wherever you want to go inside that area and however you want to fish it, it's all up to you.
Yeah, I think you've hit on one of the major things about fishing in general. It doesn't matter if you're doing it for money or not. If you're not doing it for money, if you're just out there fishing, it's a little like gambling in the sense that, like, oh, I wonder if we're doing well, da, 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 it's good. Like, oh, yeah, you got fish, yay. But if there's money involved, and we're going to talk about why there's better money in your fishery than most other fisheries in a second. But if there's real money involved, like actual money involved, the stakes go higher and the gambler's itch gets scratched quite a bit, you know, where you're just talking about the, you know, watching the net fill up and like, oh man, I hope they're all money fish, because, you know, a side note, there's five species of Pacific salmon that are swimming around and they all have different time periods, but some of them are worth more than others. Most people know that the king salmon is worth the most, and then sockeyes, and then silvers, and then the other two fish are chum and pinks. And so the money fish for us, at least, and probably for most people, are those top three. You want a full net to be full of them, or you want it to be absolutely choked with some of the others. And it's, you know, you're like, all right, come on sevens. And then, you know, the opposite of that is, I don't think we had more than one water haul in all the times that we fished together.
They're pretty rare. I mean, it's a big net. Sometimes it's one pretty not particularly valuable fish.
So a water haul, for those of you listening, is when you haul a net and there's nothing in it.
Last year, we did a pretty good job of collecting jellyfish and seaweed on occasion. But
oh, I forgot about the whole jellies. So give us a short course on jellies of the Southeast Pacific coast.
Oh my God. So everybody knows what a jellyfish is, you know, yep. All the different kinds, and that they have a variety, you know, an escalating scale of what I call spiciness. Some aren't hot at all. They're just kind of a mess. Some are blazing hot if you get them on your skin. And even though we're in rubber rain gear, every time we go to pick the net, we don't get tempted to just do it in a hoodie or something. It's always full rubber rain gear. And I run the safety glasses, the big cover half your face kind of clear glasses, and maybe even a buff over my face, because they come in and often are all commingled with the fish that are flopping around. And then pieces and specks of jellyfish go flying all over the place. And invariably, you're going to get some on you.
Oh, remember you got that one in your eyelid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right in the eyeball, too. I've seen them coming across, like you could see it coming through the air, and there's just nothing you can do about it.
It's breathtaking. It's not as bad as a Portuguese man of war, but it's just this side of it. So it literally makes you gasp when you get hit full on by the. Those are really the red wine colored ones.
They're the red ones. They're the spicy ones. Those are the hottest ones. The ones that are hotter colored tend to be more spicy. My worst one was I got done picking a set and putting the net back out, and then I went up on the little fly bridge on top of the house and sat down and took my gloves off and rubbed my eyes because I was, 3 days into it and real tired, and proceeded to jam jellyfish right into my eyeballs. Oh,
God.
That took, a good half hour to recover from that one. Streaming tears, crying, wondering about all the bad decisions that got me to this place in my life.
Of which there can be many. I mean, I think this is just talking for a second. It's just like, that's another thing to this, is that the best stories, you can work in an office and you can have some good stories, I guess, but there's nothing quite like, remember that time you backed up over the net and you had to jump over the side and cut the net free, and then your hands got so cold that you stabbed yourself by mistake? Like, this actually happened. And you just don't get those stories when you're like working in a cubicle.
No, you don't feel alive in the same way. I've heard it called like type 2 fun. Type 1 fun would be just any old thing, an amusement park ride or something. Like, oh yeah, that was fun. That was great. Type 2 is like, maybe kind of miserable at the time. Maybe kind of like, oh my God, a little scary. What the hell am I doing here? But then you look back on it, you're like, man, that was fun. Wasn't that great that time we did that thing? It's pretty much pegged on the type 2 fun meter.
Interesting. I had not heard about that. That definitely makes sense, though.
Because those are the things you remember, diving under the boat 20 times with a little red handle Vicky to cut the net out, or getting towed and put on anchor by my neighbor, who I still hear about it when his kid comes over and picks him up.
It's like I have a fishing guy friend named Jay Lopes who I've been fishing with him for damn near 15 years. And right when he started 15 years ago, we were jetting around San Francisco Bay looking for halibut. He was and is a damn good guide. But all of this jetting around, he kind of forgot to look at his gas gauge. And so we ran out of gas. And so for 15 years, I've never let him hear the end of it.
Oh, man. Get the tow job. Bummer.
Yeah, I mean,
we are turning the barrel. We all have breakdowns. We all need help once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of those things that really... It's the yin and the yang. There's that time, and this actually happened. There's that time we chipped glacial ice for our bourbon at the end of the day. And then there's that time there where, you broke down during the middle of the rush.
Right. I don't know. You got to live life, do it while you can.
So let's talk about why you're in this particular fishery. It's not just salmon and not just gill netting. So one of the things that we do, or we did, or you still do, that is special is this whole high-end processing of the fish on board. First, describe what we do, and then tell me, was this like initially the plan, or was this something that you came upon after you started fishing?
So what we do that's a little bit different than most boats, there's maybe a couple handfuls of us around in the gillnet fleet statewide that do this. Growing portion of trollers, so hook and line salmon fishermen do this, is called pressure bleeding. So you've got a little water pump that feeds through a hose with a controllable valve and a needle they come from, they're used for like filling up food grade stuff like a tincture bottle or something. So it's pretty small. It's like a 12 gauge needle. We are taking the fish on board. We're taking most often the head and the guts out, and then putting this needle in the artery that runs right along the backbone of the fish and letting this dribble of water go through and basically embalm the fish with seawater so that it gets all the blood out of the fish. And the idea of that is that that's where most of the bacteria is in a fish right when it comes out of the water. So we're trying to preserve it as fresh as possible for as long as possible. And by doing this, pressure bleeding and getting all of the blood out, you're left with these incredible headed and gutted fish that turns into amazing fillets. So if you take a salmon that isn't pressure bled or bled at all and cut down and do your fillet cut, you're going to wind up with a big, you have a kind of a dark colored bloodline along the whole side where the ribs are. And these fish, they don't have that at all. You wouldn't see any blood in the belly walls, any blood going down the backbone. And that makes it so that our fish taste cleaner and fresher, and they can keep for, you know, I've fished for over 2 years now in the freezer as part of my taste test program. That's great. I'd put it up against anybody else's 3-month-old fish in the freezer that just, however they do it at home.
The thing that I always tell people with a pressure bled fish is when you thaw a pressure bled fish, especially if you thaw it correctly, which is to say slowly, and you cook it in your kitchen, you don't get that salmon stink that everybody pretty much knows, because salmon are bloody and they're oily. And if you don't take care of the blood, that bacteria that you were talking about, it's very slowly just kind of makes the fish go off just a little bit, where it's still edible, but it's different. And it's a very specific smell that virtually nobody likes. And this takes care of that.
I feel like it does. I mean, I started being introduced to these kinds of fish really when I started at Asmund, when we were looking for fish that was, all right, we're going to do an event. We want the best fish. Well, these are the kind of producers that we were interested in working with and impressing folks.
And this is the difference between, you know, Yacobi or Taku River sockeye, which is what you guys do, or and Copper River, which is another company that does the same thing, and Costco. So the Costco fish are caught in a big giant purse seine. Just imagine like a big giant, you know, those big mesh things that you put onions in, if you're thinking about it outside. It's a little bit like that. But now imagine an enormous, ginormous, ginormous one just packed to the gills with sockeye salmon that is then dumped out onto the deck and then not bled and not taken care of and then put on ice. And then that's your Costco salmon, which is why that salmon is significantly cheaper.
Yeah, they also do take some gillnet fish, for sure. You know, there's a variety of quality standards depending on the producer, how, what kind of bleeding they do. They most certainly aren't pressure bleeding most fish. That's a pretty rare thing. But, you know, we do have, like, if you're in the Portland, Oregon area, we're in New Seasons Market. They do a whole bunch of our Trollcott coho salmon, and it's all pressure bled. That's the spec for our fleet. So that's pretty cool.
Quick shout out to one of our sponsors, and that is Filson. Anybody who knows me knows that I wear Filson because Filson doesn't break. It isn't cheap, but neither should it be, because it lasts forever. And one of the greatest things that I have of theirs is their Mackinaw jacket. If you're not familiar with this jacket, it is a kind of like a heavy boiled wool overcoat that you can wear anywhere from kind of cold to really cold. And for over 120 years, Filson has been the most trusted outfitter for this kind of outdoor sport, trade, and adventure wear. And for almost as long, they've been making that Mackinaw cruiser jacket. Originally patented way back in 1914, this jacket has become a legend in its own right. Spanning generations as the hallmark of an outdoor coat. Made in the United States, it's heavyweight, all-wool body. Has classic snap flap pockets and a full-width rear pocket that I use as a game vest when I go grouse hunting. This jacket has often been imitated and never been matched. They last forever. I've had mine for at least a decade, and I know some that have lasted for many decades. Shop at Filson.com for the new limited edition green and black plaid Mackinaw jacket. I have the forest green, but the green and black plaid sounds every bit as cool. Thanks to Filson for helping to sponsor this show. Back to it.
More to me, the enemy is low-grade farm salmon brought in. Like, most people don't know that most of the salmon consumed in the United States is farmed. And most of the farmed salmon in the United States comes from Chile.
Yep. And so a Chilean Atlantic farm salmon, which, by the way, is farmed in the Pacific, it's your McDonald's of salmon.
Right. So if you go to almost any kind of sushi joint or wherever they're serving any kind of salmon, you know, it's mostly that. Another important part of being involved in a wild salmon fishery is that, you know, I get to work on trying to keep wild places wild so we can keep having these salmon, which have been so special and so important to me throughout my whole life.
So by law, correct me if I'm wrong, but by law, all fisheries in Alaska are required to be sustainable, right?
Well, yeah, they're required to thrive. I mean, it's in the Constitution. Obviously, the devil's in the details, or however you want to put it. But we're trying, you know, and for the most part, have done a very good job. I mean, you look back through history, and there's more salmon now than there were at statehood. And what happened was outlawed corporate-owned fish traps, created a whole different structure of owners of the fishery being the harvesters, and putting this idea of sustainability into the Constitution, which then took, I don't know, man, I studied the history of it, and it took some really hard decisions for a few years to completely shut down what fisheries there were. But turns out, with protected habitat and, you know, improved management, the fish came back. And when I say more, I mean like an order of magnitude more. There weren't even 30 million fish caught in all of Alaska in 1964, but, you know, this last year there was over 200 million.
Oh, wow. One thing I found really fascinating about our fishery is, you know, we've got a net that's effectively a quarter mile long. And I mean, I think maybe in a month of fishing, I would need two hands to count the number of not salmon in that net. I mean, it's still to this day is gobsmacks me that 99.9999% of all fish in that net are salmon. And then the tiny minority are either starry flounder. First of all, I don't know why starry flounder is up high in the water column. Sometimes we set nets in 400 feet of water, which is weird.
Yeah, but they do. What the heck are they doing up there?
Exactly. So, but they're always alive. I've never seen a dead one. I mean, we could fish a month and maybe we'll get three steelhead, but that's it. And I've never seen anything else in net. I mean, you saw you caught a sturgeon once, but it's like, it's so rare as to be noteworthy.
Oh, it was very rare. You know, I'm the only hunter I know who's caught one. But it swam off, you know, it was fine.
Yeah, sturgeon are pretty mellow.
But again, what was he doing in a 28-foot deep net in 650 feet of water? What on earth was going on in his mind?
Yeah, but isn't that interesting, though?
Like, it is, and it's like, you know, part of that is having a lot of history with it. So the whole region is broken up into districts and sub-districts, and where they allow us to fish with that particular kind of gear at that time of year, they do a really good job of focusing in on and have a good idea where those salmon are traveling to and trying to keep us as clean as possible. And they do that with all the fishing. So there's areas where you're allowed to fish with a seine or gill net or hook and line, and those places are limited trying to target the target species. And it's, you know, it's pretty incredible, really, how clean the fishery is compared to what you hear.
Well, yeah, and compared to something like a bottom trawl or a shrimp net that in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, I've run shrimp nets in the Gulf, and there's all kinds of things in the shrimp net.
Well, yeah, you're dragging it along the bottom. You're going to get a lot of interesting stuff going in there.
Well, even, yeah, not all shrimp nets are touch bottom. In fact, you really don't want them to touch bottom, but they're close to the bottom. But yeah, it's just like it's a menagerie. And the utter lack of bycatch in the Alaska salmon fishery is pretty surprising.
Hope we get to keep doing it.
Yeah.
The thing we hear sometimes is like the rivers of origin. You know, for me, everything's going into the Taku, which a lot of that river, most of the spawning habitat of that river is in Canada. So we're operating under the Pacific Salmon Treaty of what proportion of those fish goes to which users, always with the eye that, you know, what is most important is getting the spawning stock back so we can keep doing it in the future.
That leads to another piece to the sort of the realities of being a commercial fisherman, which is to say, I'm pretty sure that if you're a boat captain, you can't escape endless amounts of, if not actually being at meetings, but really following the international treaties that govern how you can fish and how much you can fish and so on and so forth. And I know you specifically have, you know, all those years at ASME, which is part and parcel of what they do. Yeah. I mean, so it's not just like, it is the greatest office in the world, like we were talking about. But then in the off season, it's just, you know, an endless series of pretty contentious and complicated meetings.
Yeah. There's all different fronts to it. There's the gear conflict. So I want to be able to fish on these days because I'm a gill netter, and the seiners are like, well, we want to fish on these days because we're a seiner. And then the board of fish decides who gets to fish when and where. That's a rotating cycle. Every 3 years, they come back to all the southeast issues, and there's always a menagerie of proposals to make changes in boundary lines or whatever for the fishery. And, you know, we certainly weigh into that. And then there's the, you know, all the other things, which I view as sometimes like an existential threat of, you know, bycatch from other fisheries or, you know, larger federal fisheries. And they're not coming to the Board of Fish to talk about my salmon. They're fishing for something else, maybe out in the Gulf of Alaska when the salmon are way out there in juveniles or the Bering Sea. And then there's international treaties like the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And there's issues in, say, U.S. politics of whether or not to protect certain habitats from mining or logging or whatever. And it all plays in to, you know, the future of the fishery and whether this investment in the family farm that's a boat and a pile of net bags and a permit is, you know, going to be worth it and able to pay the bills.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were just talking a couple of years ago about when the last administration had the tariffs with China. And you know more detail than I do, but it was basically something like the price for chum salmon just dropped through the floor and it really, really affected the entire fishery.
Sure, there's that one, or the one that's happening right now is there's been since 2014 when Russia invaded Crimea and we put some sanctions on them, they banned the import of American seafood. So since 2014, we haven't been able to sell fish into Russia, which was a big market for pinks and pink salmon roe in particular.
Ah, it was a big market. Okay.
I mean, big-ish, you know, but certainly significant for specific species. Well, then we haven't reciprocated. Since then, our consumption of Russian seafood has gone up almost 200%. I go down to my local Costco right here down the road in Juneau, Alaska, and there's Russian king crab for sale.
Weird. That might be changing quite rapidly.
Yeah, you think. You know, that might be, but then there's always some complexities to things, and there's those restaurants that sell crab or whatever that want to keep having access to whatever. Seems crazy to me that we're put at such a disadvantage and they're allowed into this market just unfettered. That was one, and so that's been going on since 2014. The Chinese tariff thing was just completely out of the blue to us and absolutely cratered the market for chum salmon in particular, which was pretty devastating. But, you know, we're just small. We're like roadkill in these big conversations, you know, whether it's about steel or aluminum or, you know, corn or something. Fisheries are often not even considered in these kinds of talks.
It's all very interesting for people who don't necessarily know that. You know, you think about, oh, well, fish are expensive and your price is your price and da-da-da. But while it's not agriculture, it's affected by many of the same international problems that, say, wheat prices or corn prices. All of this, it's a global market. And even a small fisherman, like it's you and your deckhand, that's it. Get swept up in these real international, you know, brouhahas. And it can be great or it can be disheartening depending on which way the winds blow.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, this business, wild seafood is not rational. you don't necessarily get more fish because you're willing to pay a little more to, you know, I'm talking about wholesalers, right? There's long-term relationships. You don't know what you're going to catch at the beginning of the year. You don't know what you're going to get paid for the fish that you're going to catch at the beginning of the year. You don't know how many. You don't know the timing. You don't know what the market's going to be like in 6 months, maybe, when you're finally getting through most of your pack. It's kind of crazy.
So to that end, we actually had an entire episode about sea-to-table kind of deals. So if somebody listening to this is like, you know what, I want to buy Tyson's salmon. How do I do that? You can, right? Because Taku is working with Yakobi Fisheries to do direct-to-consumer, right?
Right. And that's been a growth, you know, a growing thing. From when we first started, we were not really prepared for the demand and the interest people had. But now we've got a full-blown website. YakobiFisheries.com. There's a store there. And our model isn't like you just want to buy a pound of salmon for dinner. You know, we would gladly direct you to good purveyors, and there are many great fishmongers all over the country. We would be looking more at shares, like 20 to 40 pounds, or even custom orders of more. We do buying clubs, we call them. So somebody gets together, a group of friends, and we're then able to offer more of a full-blown wholesale price on it because we save on shipping. So we can maybe ground ship with frozen containers instead of air shipping with dry ice and that kind of stuff, all with the idea that we're trying to have value for folks and get people the goods, but not go broke ourselves trying to do it.
Yeah, my brother did that. My brother got together with his office mates, and I think they bought 100 pounds or something to that effect, and they loved it.
Yeah, great. I mean, that model works terrific for us, especially if you can work with Alaska Airlines Air Cargo. I'm a big fan of shipping with them instead of FedEx because there's a cold chain. Most of their offices at least have a cooler, which is, you know, obviously huge when it's 90 degrees outside down in America in September.
Listen to you, down in America. Alaska's America.
I love it when I say that. So I vote for your benefit, Hank.
It's funny, in Mexico, if you're in the Yucatan, the Yucatecans refer to like going to Mexico. It's the same deal.
Yeah, I get it. All politics is local. The difference being that it's our average temperature in June is 58 degrees. So, you know, I know you love that part of being up here.
Well, it's cold and awful when you're not fishing, but keep in mind what we were talking about 20 minutes ago, where when we're hauling nets, you're wearing full rubber gear. And I definitely remember that day. It was so-called warm, which is to say it was over 70. And for whatever reason, we decided to fish in like this narrow cove, and we just got annihilated by biting flies. It was so bad, dude. And because we were in this cove, and the water had warmed enough, there was like 8 trillion pounds of algae on our net.
Oh, the tobacco juice.
Oh, so for you listening out there, if there's algae on your net, that makes your net really visible. And the fish are like, hey, man, that doesn't look good. I'm going to swim deeper or I'm going to turn left. And they don't get in your net. And so when you have algae in your net, you've got to take the algae out of your net. But usually when you have algae in your net, it's pretty warm. And just makes everything just sweaty and gross. And there's a reason why you need a 20-minute shower when you get off the boat.
Yeah, I mean, the deckhand's job on those days is a lot of times to run the hose. You got to spray the net, wash it off every time.
Yeah, you're like pressure cleaning this monofilament net.
Yeah, the last, you know, first opener last year, there was a lot of algae. But there was some fish in there. The guys weren't getting it because they were just putting the net out and not realizing that the algae had their net not fishing after about 15 minutes. So we were turning sets about every half hour.
Oh, wow. So for normal is 90 minutes, right?
Ish. You know, it depends obviously on a number of things. If I'm trying to catch the tide or something, I might make a set knowing that I'm not actually fishing yet. In an hour, I'm going to be in position and then the tide's going to come through and a wave of fish.
That is a chess game. So talk to me about that chess game. It's always interesting because as a deckhand, all I do is clean fish and make sure everything is good on deck. I don't point the boat anywhere. I don't have any decisions on where the net goes, but that's all you. And there's, I don't know, I mean, a dozen other two-person gill netting boats in our area that we see all the time. And it's kind of, like you said, it's we're all in this together, but kind of not. And, you know, our chief rival is the Fun Boat, which is run by a Norwegian father and son team, which are great. They're great humans. I like them a lot, but they're just very different. And it's kind of like the Dodgers and the Giants kind of thing. And we're always trying to get in front of each other. So I mean, you've been doing this for years now. So there's got to be all kinds of fun chess moves that you can describe.
There's kind of the rules of the road. First off, is that, you know, this is a gentleman fishery, so it's not like what you might see in Bristol Bay or something where boats are setting right on top of each other. We give each other a quarter mile, which is just a little more than the length of our net. If somebody already has their net out, not supposed to set within a quarter mile. There's no law or whatever, depending on who it is, would get a different reaction. And if you're fishing on a boundary line, you get 20 minutes. So from when you start putting your net out, the next person in line sets a clock, and at 20 minutes, they can put their net out. And sometimes we'll just talk to each other if there's only a couple of us, and we'll say, hey, how about we give each other 25 minutes or whatever, sometimes. But where we fish, there's severe tides and back eddies, and it's just a big river mouth. There's river water flowing through the salt water, creating all these crazy currents, both on the surface, plus the major tides, plus wind. So there are better spots than others when you want to try to be there for the tide change, or when you think the right timing is to, you know, to get your net in front of some fish. Well, everybody else wants in there too. So you, and looking through the binoculars all the time, sitting there in between sets, planning the next move, watching the end of the net, keeping the net in shape. And then when the time's right, we pick it up and we find another spot to put it down. If we like where we're at, you know, the ideal thing is just to get to the end of the net and start putting it right back out again to maximize the amount of time that your net's in the water. You know, obviously you don't catch any fish when you're driving around. So if you can keep your fishing, that's good, but you also don't want to do that just for the sake of keeping it wet when maybe the tide's running the right way all the way over on the other side and you want to get yourself in position over there. One of my favorite moves is things are getting really busy and competitive. If there's peak weeks on the Taku when boats from around southeast that have the same permit I do come to my district to fish, I've got a little advantage that I'm mostly there all year and kind of have a feel for when is the right time to be in the right spot. And maybe I'll start picking a set, but I want to hold my spot, but I need to get fish out of the net. And then I see somebody coming in who wants to set over me because I've started picking, so I gave up my spot. Well, I'll just turn right. I'll just put it in forward and start putting the net right back out when I see them start coming to maintain my spot. And then drive around and pick part of the net on the inside and do it again. That's one that always gets a fun reaction.
Yeah, that's a new one. I don't think you did that when I was aboard.
Yeah, by the time, you know, I think we're coming mostly into July, August, kind of after the main super competitive part of the peak. I mean, we still caught some fish, but it wasn't the giant days and the people that make it busy. Like, you know, we have our regular couple dozen boats that fish the area. Well, when it's really busy, there have been as many as, you know, 120 in the district.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. I've never even seen a quarter of that in terms of boats in our district before.
Yeah. So you're over on, say, Pete's Rockside, and it's three deep all the way down. There's 20 boats along that beach. Mm. So when you're trying to work your way into a good spot on the tide change, it's a little more competitive than what we saw.
Talk to me about the end. The end of that season is September to October. It's already damn near winter in Southeast Alaska. And that end period's got to be kind of weird and special and bittersweet for you, isn't it?
It is. It turns into the real grind. It's starting to get dark at night. So your days are wind up being shorter. You have hours sitting on the hook between, you know, it's not really worth fishing at night because it's real scratch fishing. In that we're not getting hundreds of fish per set. We're getting maybe a couple hundred fish for the whole opener for 3 days. So I'm really thoughtful about where we have the net out and when, but there's not a lot of people around at the same time. Spend a lot of time looking on the beach for deer. The show season opens on September 15th. I usually try to wrap something around that so I can go try to get a beach deer. Yeah, it's, you know, the weather can be awful enough to blow us off the water, where it's just your calculation of whether it's worth being out there when a net's worth $7,000, and obviously you don't want to drive over it, or you're just getting slammed around in the boat and you're going, oh my god, what on earth am I even doing here right now? I could just go home. But you know, the ones people that make a living at it and don't wind up having to do a whole lot of other things, they're out there and they put in the days. I'm definitely taking note of that.
It's mostly silver salmon in the end, right?
It's exclusively silver salmon by then. I mean, the whole last almost 6 weeks of the season is mostly all silver. So it, you know, it starts off with the chums and the early sockeyes and a few king salmon around. But you know, our fishery, because we fish so shallow, we don't get a lot of kings, really, you know, and that's by design. And they're protecting the king salmon runs. Rightfully so. So we're kept out of areas where traditionally maybe we would have caught more kings. At that time, to let them get by and improve an escapement. And then it moves on to the pinks start showing up the end of July, early August, and, you know, then it's kind of the cohos start, and by the end of September, when we're off the water, that's when I'm done, by the 20th or 25th, usually. Last year, they kept it open for another couple of weeks, but the processing plant was closed, and it was time. It was time to not really to go anymore. I went one more Saturday, almost into October, and we caught, I don't know, a couple dozen fish, and said that'll be enough for home pack. I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, then you're the captain aboard the Heather Ann, but you work with some other people for crabs and sometimes other fish, don't you?
Yeah, and I had a Dungeness crab permit for several years. I was doing that on the side while I worked at ASME and did some salmon trolling, even, you know. So
and hell of it.
Get the full-time deal. Sport fish, and Chris, my partner here in Juneau, he fishes halibut and black cod, and just got done tanner crab fishing, which I know you like.
I do.
Paradise crab, good one of the two snow crab. You know, that's pretty gnarly, just out there and through the middle of February.
Yeah, that is the deadliest catch, except probably the waters aren't as fierce as they are in the Bering Sea.
It's inside waters, but the boats are a lot smaller too. I mean, he's doing it out of a 55-foot old wood boat. So it's not like it's a 150-foot proper Bering Sea crab boat.
If you had it to do over again, because obviously you're committed with the Heather Ann and committed as a gill netter, if you had it to do over again, would you choose a different style of fishing or a different fishery?
This is perfect for me right now because we fish generally a few days a week. The season's pretty long from middle of June through September, and it's close to my home. So I'll be on the water fishing for 3-4 days a week, usually. Like Sunday at noon is when we're allowed to set the net, 12:01 actually. And then till Tuesday, sometimes Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, even we fished until last year, a couple of weeks. And then I can drive the 2.5 hours back and be at home. So with kids and all that, that meant I didn't have to leave and then fish 100 straight days out on the outer coast, which is something I was trying to avoid. Now that they're getting older, and my thought is more to diversify, so I can do this and maybe even rig the boat up for power trolling, and kind of do a little bit of both on the salmon side. Might get some quota to fish black cod a little bit. What I wouldn't trade at all, though, is being connected to the direct marketing part of it. That's an important piece for me. Certainly could make more money, say, if I'd have gone all in and been going to Bristol Bay, or, you know, there's a number of other fisheries that are more lucrative, but just didn't offer the same lifestyle, and that was an important piece for me.
It seems a bit like an analog with if you are a commodity farmer, like a livestock commodity farmer versus a farmer raising heritage breeds. So it's a smaller farm, and the quality's higher, and you still make a decent living, but you don't make the kind of living that you would make if you were Tyson, for example. The chicken chain, not you.
Oh, what have you been hiding out on me? Yeah, it's very much the same. And even that's reflected in some of our best customers are the people that they are in farmers markets with those very same kind of farmers. You kind of have a circuit of that. We would catch fish and then ship it down. And like Savory Alaska, Hook and Line. There's a number of them, you know, from Central Texas to Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Before I let you go, A, people want to know how to be able to find you on the series of tubes that we call the internet. And then I also would like to close with, what would be your advice for somebody who wants to get into commercial fishing? Not necessarily as a boat owner, but just to do it.
That's a good question. That's a good one. My advice, you know, try it. Do it. Get to know some folks and see if you can make connections that are references. Because you're not only trying to get on any boat to get any job. You should also be interviewing the captain and checking out the boat. Because as you pointed out, it can be dangerous or it can be awful. But if you get along with folks and the boat's well-maintained, it's a good option. And maybe start small. Don't think that you're immediately going to be on a deadliest catch crab boat. Those are coveted jobs and serious, real deal professional fishermen. If you're looking to get started, think about maybe getting on with a tender come up to one of the main harbors and be around and introduce yourself and offer to help with boat work, because that's the piece that people miss on is they think you just go out and you catch a bunch of fish and you make a bunch of money and then you go home. There's really year-round work for most operations.
Right now,
I'm pretty happy the snow melted in the yard, so I can drag a net bag over to the garage and strip it down and rebuild it. There's some boat projects I want to get done. So that part of the work is expected if you're going to be starting on fishing, and that winds up being super important out on the water, that you have somebody that you can trust when you need to, I don't know, fix something, do something. You know, so much of fishing, especially as a deckhand, is not about catching fish. That's the job of the guy with the boat.
Oh, yeah. I think the other thing that if you do get on board that I can give to people as an advice is stay awake. I mean more than just the, you know, your eyes open. There's a right way and a wrong way to do things on a boat. And the wrong way can often get you injured or killed. I'm not even really exaggerating on that. Like if you get your foot caught in a rope that is flying overboard because it's got pots in it or a long line or a net, you could die. I mean, it's not, you know, not necessarily going to happen, but you sure as hell are not going to forget it if you do survive it. There's a certain right way to coil a line, you know, to stand, to shuffle your feet, to, you know, be braced if there's high seas there. Even as simple as getting up in the middle of the night to take a piss. You need to have your wits around you, because if you're sleepy, or God forbid, you know, you had more than a beer or two before you hit the rack, you could fall over and die and no one would know. and it has happened. Wasn't there somebody who died? He was fishing solo and they never saw him?
Oh yeah. Every so often. That's the reality.
Yeah. So it's
anchor, or you name it.
It's a tough job.
But it's also, if you do take that care, it can be very safe. And most accidents are when people are fishing solo, super tired, all of those things. I mean, I feel confident enough in it that I regularly take my sons out. And they're 13 now, and they're damn good deckhands. They're also kind of grew up around the water, so they know what's going on. I should mention, too, there's a pretty cool apprenticeship program Alaska Longline Fishermen Association does for young fishermen, for people that want to get started in those fisheries.
And Longline, I'll post a link to our favorite rap music video of all time, which is an excellent tune called Bait It, Set It, Haul It. That's a long line for halibut. And you get to see what it is while listening to the best rap song of all time. Maybe not, but it's a fun one.
The best commercial fishing rap song of all time.
Although there you go.
His whole collection of work is pretty amazing.
I'll definitely post a link to that in the show notes.
Pretty niche genre.
Well, Tyson, thank you for coming on. How can people find you on the internet?
At yakobifisheries.com. That's yakobifisheries.com. Or you can ask if you want to see just my salmon operation and maybe even some pictures of Hank Shaw on the social medias, Instagram at Taku Salmon. That's TakuSalmon on the Instagram.
The gram. And you're actually quite good at keeping up the Instagram feed during the season. So it's kind of cool to sort of follow along with what Tyson and the Heather Ann is up to.
Yeah, good, bad, and the ugly. I mean, last year you got to see some pictures of my broken reduction gear.
That was not ideal.
Engine room, but we got back at it. We recovered pretty well.
The last thing I remember is like we were fishing together and something broke and you had to buy, you're like, you know what? I'm going to buy two because the next time that thing breaks, I will just be able to fix it and not run all over God's creation trying to get something. You know, that it might have been a transmission thing.
Oh my God. Yes. Everything. I've got a spare everything on the boat now. I need a spare captain.
And seriously, when does your season start?
Father's Day.
June.
Mid-June, whichever Sunday is Father's Day. Have that pretty well booked for the time being.
All right. This will air prior to your season start.
Nice. When is that going to happen?
Yes. You'll know.
Oh, I won't miss it. Right on.
Hey, all right.
Thanks for talking.
Well, that is our show for this week. I am your host, Hank Shaw, and this is the Hunt Gather Talk podcast sponsored by Filson and eFish. I really appreciate you spending some part of your day with us, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. As usual, you can follow me on social media. I am on Instagram at Hunt Gather Cook. I also run a Facebook group, which is also called Hunt Gather Cook. You have to answer some questions and then I will let you in. Just say that you are a podcast listener. The core of what I do is Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook. That is my website. You can find it on huntgathercook.com. And you will find literally thousands of recipes for wild foods, ranging from fish to game to edible wild plants and mushrooms. So follow me there. Hope to find you and have a good week. And I will talk to you soon.